Our science man Sean Duke is here. Morning, Sean.
Hi, Declan.
Good to talk to you in summer weather.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
And you're looking all summery as well.
Yeah. Have my red trousers on now. Hopeful.
Yeah. Anyhow, we've got a couple of topics here from the news this week. And what'll be of concern to parents, of course, is antibiotics. And you were looking at this and saying perhaps repeated courses of antibiotics can harm children's development.
Yeah, antibiotics, of course, are being used more and more. We know that. And with kids, very young children are getting antibiotics. Sometimes, you know, only a couple of weeks old, one of our kids got antibiotics. So it's very common. This is a study from the States, from NYU, which is a reputable medical university there. And the first thing to say is that we would be like the States, I would think. And they reckon that the average child in the US has 10 courses of antibiotics by the time they're 10. So, you know, we're getting that direction here as well. There are downsides with this. Now, the first thing is they've looked at this in mice, okay? But mice, it hasn't been looked at in humans, but the studies are very clear in mice. And what they found was that if you are treated repeatedly with amoxicillin, which is a fairly common one that a lot of us would have had, and some other very common antibiotics, repeated doses, there's negative effects. The two main negative effects is weight gain, and also there's an impact on your bones. But perhaps most important is the whole... Your gut is made up of these bacteria, and there's a balance there. And what these antibiotics do is they seem to knock out the metabolism of the child completely and reprogram it. And what the scientists are saying is that the reprogramming of the balance of your gut is actually making you predisposed towards obesity. So there's a link here that's been found with a predisposition for obesity, which is a massive problem, of course, in Ireland. We now have, would you believe, I looked at the statistics, 1/4 of all adults are obese, half of all in Ireland, and half of all adults are overweight. So here's another thing that kind of ties into that, that maybe the use of antibiotics has other impacts that we didn't know about, because there are other downsides with antibiotics too. Superbugs, of course, that if you use them too much, that the bugs find a way to respond, and then the antibiotics become useless. So, you know, here's another downside. I think, in general, we probably use them far too much, far too readily, but maybe some doctors would disagree with that.
I don't think so. I think they're rowing back from using antibiotics.
Yeah, you know? Because you have antibiotics of last resort now, they call them.
Yeah, so it's the superbugs they're worried about.
Superbugs they're worried about. And, you know, there's not just one. There's not just MRSA. There's a whole load of them. There's another one, C. difficile, which kills huge numbers as well in Ireland and all over the world. So, and there's new ones emerging. So really... and the problem is that we're not creating new antibiotics. So the bugs are becoming smarter. They're staying ahead of the antibiotics that have been there for a while. And we're not really making any new ones. So there you go. Maybe with the kids, unless they really need it, maybe you don't need the antibiotics so much.
Do video games inspire violent behaviour? There's a huge debate always ongoing about this as the new games come out and they've looked for over 18 certificates and all that, and then people say, well, are people reliving their fantasies through the games and they don't take it into real life? Or in some cases, do they?
Yeah, this, again, it's a really old debate. I was surprised. I had a look, and it goes back right back to the Victorian era, where there were these magazines, Penny Dreadful magazines, which people were saying at the time that these were causing youngsters who were reading them to become more violent. And in the modern era, we have these video games. And I suppose the first time that this became a massive issue in America in particular was the Columbine Massacre. Do you remember that? That was 1999, I think it was. Where these two teenagers ran amok and shot lots of people in their local school. It was found out afterwards that they'd been playing this game called Doom, the two teenagers, where they, you know, where you were a shooter, basically, and they'd been playing this game obsessively. So the parents of the children and some of the victims sued the company. The case didn't stand up in court, but it became a massive issue. Lots of research into it then following that in the States, but the bottom line, there's a lot of stuff that you can read, but the bottom line is there's no actual causal link here whatsoever. That they haven't been managed, like with cigarettes and cancer, to definitively say that these violent video games cause people to actually behave violently. There are some things that are not good about them, about the video games, like they teach certain aggressive behaviours. But apparently the key thing that scientists find for children in terms of violence and being violent is if they look at other adults. If they look in the real world at parents or people that they know or whomever, and they see them behaving violently, that's where they get their key from. So, and there's also a suggestion with very vulnerable kids that might have mental issues, they could be at risk from the video games, the evidence suggests. But the vast majority of kids, boys I suppose in particular, it seems like what they're doing with these video games, it's a form of play. It's just kind of like pushing and shoving and the normal type of playing. It's not really malicious, you know. So
they're absorbed in a game of cowboys and Indians. And
exactly.
They know the difference between that and real life.
Exactly. Unless there's some kind of issue there with the child to begin with, and then maybe they're vulnerable. So the risk has been overstated. And actually, it's interesting because some of the games improve coordination, hand-to-eye coordination and things like that, and memory even. So, you know, it's not all bad.
Yeah, I'm sure the debate will continue. Friends first romantic relationships.
Yeah, this is an interesting one in the Independent in England, and they looked at the difference between people who get romantically involved, that actually it's love at first sight. So you see this person, you just love them and you're together straight away. And then the other situation, which is common as well, where you could be friends for a long period of time and then eventually you get together. And what's going on there? They just wanted to look at it, and what they found is that if it's love at first sight, then physical attraction is number one. And the big question they were asking is, why do people that are very similar seem to end up together in terms of physical attraction? And there was one famous experiment where they got the photographs, I think it was about 10 photographs of women, 10 photographs of men, and they asked the women and men to grade them according to attractiveness, and they graded them, and then they matched up perfectly with the people who are couples. So we tend to a lot of the time be with people who are at the same level of physical attractiveness, have similar psychology, similar behaviour, similar interests, okay? But sometimes that's not the case, and it seems with these friends relationships, which can be very successful as well, is that over a period of time, you look at people in a different light, that you say, okay, there's, you know, I don't particularly like that particular physical feature, the nose, the eyes, whatever it is, but over time it doesn't become important and you became gradually attracted and then you end up together. And if you look then at the outcomes in terms of how people stay together, it's exactly the same. So if you have this love at first sight attraction, or if you're not physically attracted but you end up together, chances are the same that you're going to stay together.
Right, okay. So the agony aunt Stolen, who is Sean Duke, our cool scientist, with a separate parallel career. Yep. And finally, fingerprint developed that identifies individuals' unique sense of smell.
Yeah, so we have the DNA we have the fingerprint, and then we have the DNA fingerprint, and now we've got what they call the olfactory fingerprint, which is to do with our sense of smell. And we've got 6 million smell receptors apparently in each of our noses, and there's 400 different types of smell that we can look at. Now, why is this important? So they can, basically what they're doing is they've worked it out mathematically. They ask you to distinguish between two odours, or maybe three odours, or maybe four odours, and based on your responses, they can define a precise olfactory fingerprint for you based on what you're smelling and your perception of smell. And if you look at 34 different odours that are out there in the world, and you get people to analyse those or ask them questions based on those, you can then definitively identify every single person on the planet's olfactory fingerprint different to everybody else's. It's amazing. Why would we want to do this? Well, I suppose police stuff is would be one thing maybe, but apart from that, organ match. If you have a certain type of smell, then you can match that with an organ, that you'd be more likely to take an organ on board and not reject it. You know, because if you're genetically similar to the organ that you're receiving, then your body is less likely to attack it. and reject it. So that's very important. And also, apparently, this olfactory thing can be very important for early diagnosis of brain disorders. Okay, things like Alzheimer's. With Alzheimer's, we know by the time the symptoms arrive,
it's too late.
There are already these holes in your brain. Okay, nothing can be done. This might give away of people being able to be an early warning system, maybe when people are in their 40s or early 50s, that look, there's a problem down the road. And we'd hope then that we develop a treatment. We still don't have a treatment. But so they're the two main things with this olfactory.
Scientists are
always... and I'm sure this is going to end up in the perfume industry and, you know, there'll be some kind of commercial spin-offs of this. But it's interesting that our smell, you know, when you smell something delicious, it's not exactly the same smell as the person beside you is smelling. That we perceive...
Because the receptors are different.
Yeah. We perceive and how we see things, hear things. It's all subjective. So
how's the book going?
Book is going great. Yeah, I'm now at the moment trying to understand a machine called Colossus, which is the first computer. You know, Alan Turing's, and to write about it, I have to try and understand this thing, and it's pretty detailed. But I'm getting through it anyway.
SeanDuke.com, science spinning for Sean's writings on science. Thanks very much indeed, Sean.
Thanks, Declan.
Enjoy the rest of the summer sunshine.
Thank you.